Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, our topic is teaching mindfulness to at-risk youth. Although yoga and meditation are common pursuits in the Bay Area, they are unusual in East Palo Alto, a city where the average household income is just over $40,000 per year, less than half of its wealthy neighbor, Palo Alto. This income gap contributes to communities where children often navigate trauma and violence. But a new program out of Stanford is trying to equip kids with tools to help them thrive in spite of the challenges of their environment. Tonight we focus on Cesar Chavez Academy, where children are learning mindfulness and meditation as a way to form healthier responses to the stresses they face. Can meditation and yoga help children focus better and achieve academic success and well-being? And how can this innovative program be sustained and expanded to reach more at-risk youth? Joining us to discuss these questions and more are three guests who are involved with Stanford's innovative program. Here in the studio, we have Dr. John Rettger. He's clinical psychologist and director of the Mindfulness Program in the Stanford University Early Life Stress and Pediatric Anxiety Program. In addition to his work at Stanford, John also teaches mindfulness and yoga and is a co-founder of the Blue Elephant Mindfulness Center in Palo Alto. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
And we're also joined here in the studio by Michael Fu. He's a second-year medical student at Stanford School of Medicine who has been involved in the Mindfulness Project since it began in 2012. Prior to being at Stanford, Michael taught 7th grade math on the south side of Chicago, where he developed a passion for working with youth and an interest in the impact of stress on children. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you so much. Very glad to be here.
And by phone, we're joined by Amica Guillaume, and she's been a staff member at Cesar Chavez Academy in East Palo Alto since 2004 and became the school's principal in 2010. Amica's prior experience includes working as a classroom teacher, a professor of education, and as a program director for Teach for America. She is also the president and co-founder of the Deanna Marin Foundation for Nonviolence. Welcome, Amica.
Thank you so much for having us.
And as always, we welcome you, our listeners, to be part of our conversation tonight. You can email us now at cityvisions@klw.org, or you can call us on our lines at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. We'll be taking calls in about 20 minutes. You can also post a comment at the KLW website. So, Amica Guillaume, principal of Cesar Chavez Academy in East Palo Alto, I wanted to start with you. Why don't you paint us a picture of the school that you lead?
Okay. Well, we are a small school in East Palo Alto, kinder through 8th grade. We serve about 550 students and families, and we are about 97% free and reduced, so that means that a student qualifies by being under the line of poverty. And by the 2010 census, the definition of homeless being that you're not in charge of your own address, that means you don't lease or own your own home, that 50% are homeless.
50% of your students are homeless. Mm. Wow, that's quite a striking figure. Tell us more.
So, for example, this is very illustrative of the challenges our students face and the stress. It means that you're not in charge of your address. So, for example, we have quite a few families who rent a garage or they rent a room. So the other day there was a family who had to be evacuated from their garage because the home in front was involved with some drugs and some violence and therefore was raided by the police. So I had this whole family with several children, and they came to us to the office saying, we don't have a uniform, we don't have our backpacks, everything is cordoned off by the police, I don't think we'll get back inside for another week. They ended up at a hotel or motel, and within a matter of days were running out of money to pay for the motel and still hadn't a change of clothing, still didn't have their homework. So that's a perfect example of what it means to live, you know, in a situation like many of our families in East Palo Alto.
So how can students contending with all of those stressors and uncertainties manage to stay focused in the classroom?
That's a challenge. That's an absolute challenge. And the thing that's so ironic is that we have incredible attendance rates. For consecutive years, we have between 98-99% attendance rates every single day. So I do think that despite whatever stress they have at home, they come to school regularly because it is the safe haven and because there is some reliability, there's some dependability, and there's frankly a place where they feel safe. So it is a challenge, but I also think it's something that they look for when they come to school.
And what is a typical route to school like for children? What is the environment that they traverse back and forth to school every day? Tell us a little bit more about the challenges of the communities who make East Palo Alto home.
Well, I can say that when I myself drive to school and I bring my two daughters who go to school on the same campus as we do, we pass three different but representing deaths, murders that happened on our block on the way to school. So there's one for a young man who went by the nickname Man. There is another one for one of our former students who was shot, and then another one for another former student who was shot. So there are three of these
altars.
Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. Three of them on the way to school, just within two blocks of our school. In addition to that, of course, you have just a lot of examples of poverty, and we're lucky now, thanks to the Safe Routes to School movement through San Mateo County, we do now have sidewalks. We do have safer routes to school. Before, there were not even ways to walk without having to go in the middle of the street or contend with vehicles and dogs and sometimes chickens. It is very different than walking down the street, say, in Palo Alto or Belmont on your way to school.
And tell us, in the 10 or so years that you've been working at the school, the last four or so years as its principal, how have you seen the things that children carry on their shoulders, figuratively here, how it comes into the classroom and the school environment, and what does that mean, not only for the children, but for their classmates and their teachers and so on?
It is a very, very sad challenge that so many of our students don't know how to cope with their challenges. And so for some, it manifests in just being very quiet and separate and perhaps not having the words to express themselves, so they go in sort of a deep depression of silence. For other students, they're more outgoing and their anger is manifested in being very defiant, and perhaps some would define it as disobedient. For us, we really look at it as this is a child in pain.
And what is a typical trajectory of students who come through your school? How many complete, and you said K through 12, is that right?
K through 8,
sorry. How many complete on time? How many, and what happens often to the children that you serve?
I think the best statistic is the vast majority of our students go into the Sequoia Union High School District, which is our comprehensive high school in the neighboring district that does 9 through 12. And depending on which report you reference, I know that Berkeley did a study in 2004 that uses the number only 11% graduate with A through G requirements ready for college. That was a 2004 study. Since then, I believe they say the statistics are maybe now at 30%. I don't have the latest, but it is significantly lower than the national average.
So it sounds like the impact of living in an environment that is uncertain in many ways and threatening in other ways really just bends the curve downwardly for a group of students who see your school, as you say, as a safe haven every day. But it's hard to shake off, so to speak, the impact of the environment in which they are in outside of school hours.
I think it really comes down to Maslow's hierarchy of needs. If a child is uncertain about are they loved, if they're uncertain about are they going to eat, where am I going to stay tonight, where am I living, if they're uncertain about any of those three things, they cannot attend to learning. That's just a scientific fact. And since a significant number of our students are contending with these simple questions that a child who's 8 or 13 should not have to contend with, that's going to make it difficult to learn.
So that was Amika Guillaume, and she will be here more for you throughout the hour. She's the principal of Cesar Chavez Academy in East Palo Alto, which is the focus of our program tonight on a program that is being piloted there on teaching mindfulness and meditation to at-risk youth. So now I want to bring in Dr. John Redker, who is one of the key figures in the program that we're about to hear more about. And I just wanted to hear, before we dive into the details, tell us, so your degree is in psychology. Tell us a little bit more about unpack basically what Amaka has been talking about, of how the environment that the students that she leads, how that impacts their development and their coping skills.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah, so one of the ways to kind of conceptualize some of the issues that are being faced by the students in the schools is the idea of being exposed to trauma or violence in some way. And so in psychology, we talk about something called post-traumatic stress disorder. And we often conceptualize the students as having symptoms of that disorder. So we don't do like a full evaluation to see whether or not they have the full disorder, but we can think about some of the symptoms that they're experiencing along those lines. And Amaka had mentioned a number of behavioral, academic, and mental health effects that the students face. So some of those would be poor school performance, lower reading achievement, lower verbal IQ, as well as in some cases, it doesn't sound like that's the case at Cesar Chavez, but missed school, so increased absenteeism from school. And also, it's important to note that trauma does have an effect across the lifespan. So if these kids don't get treatment for that, then it can lead to poor health outcomes later down the road. And so it's important to intervene as soon as possible to help curb some of those effects. And so mindfulness is a really, I think, effective way of trying to address some of those symptoms, because we can think of mindfulness as being a set of attention regulation skills that can help the child to remain focused and also to have an opportunity to reflect on what their emotional experience is, to learn how to identify what their feelings are, and then to notice how that might be influencing how they're behaving, and then make more skillful choices about that.
Could you sketch out for us how a child who is affected by chronic stress, it sounds like, from living in the environment we've described so far in this hour, can you draw a map for us of how children navigate a stressful situation, a situation that might many other children who don't come from that environment face? How might that child react to a stressful situation compared to others? And what does that mean down the road for them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think a child that has been exposed to one or more traumas, for example, might have something we call hyper arousal. So they would kind of be feeling on edge all the time and being unsure of their safety in the situation. They might have intrusive thoughts, so recollecting the event, and they're not able to kind of suppress those thoughts. Also feeling some emotional numbing, and so also challenges with concentration and attention. So, and there can also be other mental health conditions such as depression, anxiety that can come along with that. So,
and how does that manifest in terms of behaviors in the school?
Mm-hmm. Well, you could see, as Amaka was saying, some kids might act out angry, or some might go more inward, and those are the kids that are harder to detect. So they could be experiencing a lot of depression and feeling very anxious, but they're not acting out in ways that are observable. And so it's harder to pick up on those kids and get them the treatment they need. So it can, there's a range of behaviors that we could see. So certainly kids that aren't able to pay attention in class might be experiencing that hyperarousal. And then the kids that are more withdrawn might be experiencing the more depression-type symptoms.
So it sounds like there's a way in which the experiences really follow the children into the classroom and really sort of get in the way of their ability to engage in the classroom, mm-hmm. and then in some cases perhaps may prompt behaviors that could be really defeating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you think about a child who's in this constant state of hyperarousal, it's very difficult to learn when you're in that mindset, because you're feeling really anxious, really nervous, really worried, and it's really hard to retain information that's coming in. So it has an impact on learning in that way.
So tell us a little bit more now about how you came to work with the Cesar Chavez Academy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we our group at Stanford, we're part of what's called the Early Life Stress Research and Pediatric Anxiety Program. And so we had been working in the Ravenswood City School District for several years doing different projects with them. So we had an ongoing relationship with the school district. And so whenever I joined the team, I had brought this skill of mindfulness and yoga. And so there was an opportunity through some funding that we got from the Stanford Office of Community Health to offer a mindfulness-based program in the schools. And so we had done a study a year ago, our first mindfulness program, where we taught to third and fourth graders in the school district at several different schools. And so the project we did at Cesar Chavez this year was a continuation of the first year's project, which we made some curriculum improvements and worked with an individual school teacher to strengthen up the curriculum and see where we could go from there.
That was John Redker, and he is the director of the Mindfulness Program at Stanford University's Early Life Stress and Pediatric Anxiety Program. I want to turn next to Michael Fu, who's a second-year medical student at Stanford and a former teacher with Teach for America as well, in the south side of Chicago. And it's interesting because you kind of bridge the two conversations we've had so far, one with a school principal and one with a clinician researcher. Tell us about how you found your way to this work, and specifically tying back to the experiences you had teaching in Chicago.
Yeah, it was. So it's interesting listening to Amaka talk about how students present in the classroom with the stressors that they face at home. And I distinctly remember when I was teaching, you experience a child going through something in the morning that's preventing them from being able to do their work. And the best thing you can do as a teacher is provide time, but you're almost as like a coach saying, walk it off, you know, sort of just brush it off and do this one problem for me and then move on and we can sort of both get on with our lives and you sort of be happy. But the more and more I found myself in that situation, the more I realized there's a lot more that we weren't teaching our students and we weren't giving them the skills they needed to overcome these things. We were just sort of brushing by. We were sort of just, you know, avoiding the situation. Almost. So when I came to medical school, I had been so moved by the experiences and the families that I'd worked with in Chicago that I wanted to find people that were doing similar work in the school systems. And for me, I was not a mindfulness, you know, expert at all, and I still don't consider myself a mindfulness expert, but I happened to find Dr. Redger and Dr. Carrion's group who were implementing this mindfulness program, and it spoke to me about everything in terms of what I saw in the students that I taught, what they were facing.
So what did mindfulness mean for you? Not as a sort of someone coming in with the interest, but not necessarily knowing the process or the technique.
Right. So actually, I didn't really know much about mindfulness when I first started. For me, it was actually two things. It was one, an interest with the students, but also two, an interest in my own stresses and anxieties that I was developing as a medical student. Because when you come into medical school, you're overwhelmed with all of these new facts and information and different studying styles. And so it was also a personal approach for me to be able to realize how can I reduce my own anxiety, my own stresses that came around this period of my life. So it was sort of merged both things for me, I guess.
And so tell us more, John, about mindfulness, the concept. I imagine a lot of our listeners know about it. It's a term that perhaps is a little overused these days. But what does it really mean, and what's the practice like, not only for adults, but for children specifically?
Yeah, so our approach in working with children was primarily taking yoga poses as a way to teach the concepts of mindfulness. Because mindfulness is often thought about as seated meditation practice, and which is a pivotal part of the practice, but it's really difficult for children to sit for a sustained period of time in stillness, especially if they've been exposed to traumatic events and they have that kind of hyperarousal. So the way to think about the mindfulness-based yoga that we were teaching, it's a way for the students to learn how to get connected into what they're feeling in their bodies, and then learn how the way that they're experiencing the yoga pose is a way of looking at emotions too. Because whenever we have emotional experience, there's often a physical component of that. If you take an example of an emotion such as anger, there's a strong physiological experience of anger. You can feel your heart start to kind of beat a little faster. You might start clenching your fists. You kind of get your breath going. And so we can then teach them through yoga poses, well, what does it mean to let your body fully relax? And so working in a yoga pose is also being fully connected into the present moment. So often things like Anxiety, for example, is kind of a worry about the future. So if we're teaching kids to learn how to become more focused on the present moment, we're kind of removing the cognitive resources, I guess you can say, from that preoccupation with the future and directing it into the present moment experience of being in the classroom, being in the yoga practice where it's a safe environment. So we're giving them an opportunity to step back from the experience of anxiety.
And what research did you base your work on here? Mm-hmm. Is there work that shows that children can really grasp the concept of meditation and can really take it to employ it in the ways that you were hoping for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, research with children is newer than the research for adults. Mindfulness-based stress reduction was pioneered by Jon Kabat-Zinn several decades ago at the UMass Medical Center. And at this point in time, there's thousands and thousands of studies documenting the positive outcomes of mindfulness for a range of different mental health conditions, even working with things like chronic pain, psoriasis. So a full range of benefits have been documented in the research. And in the past decade or so, maybe a little bit more, the work has started to be adapted for children. So Amy Saltzman, who's in the Bay Area in Menlo Park, she pioneered mindfulness-based stress reduction for children. There's also some other groups like Mindful Schools in the Bay Area, Mind-Body Awareness Project. So there's a lot of people that are really applying these concepts. And so we're seeing some positive behavioral and emotional outcomes for children. And the approach to teaching it to children is certainly different. It's adapted to be developmentally appropriate. So, yeah,
Michael, you wanted to add something there.
Yeah. So I also wanted to add, John was talking about the use of mindfulness and emotions. And I think it's important to note that for students, it's mindfulness, we teach it not just as a way for them to express their emotions, but a lot of the times, you know, we were working with third and fourth graders as well as seventh graders. They just experience the emotion and they don't really understand what that means, or they don't understand that when I feel anger, I also have physiological changes in my body, like my heart starts to pound more and my blood pressure goes up and I feel these feelings, like I feel warm in my head. And then they don't realize where that emotion lies in their body. So they don't take the time to analyze or even think about what this emotion of anger really means and where it's coming from.
And what does that mean when they don't do that? What does that lead to?
So that leads to the reactiveness that we see in students, whether it's misbehavior, whether it's shutting down, you know, to a teacher's response or, you know, a teacher's direction. So it leads to the things that get the students in trouble, whether it's in trouble with the administrator or it's in trouble with themselves where they're shutting themselves out from the world. So what we do is we try to use mindfulness to get them to make observations and not to judge those observations on how their physical body is manifesting the emotions, but just to accept it and to note it and to sort of analyze it a little bit more to understand, where is this coming from? What is it actually asking of me? You know, is it actually asking me to give it some space? Like, do I really need to be angry right now? So it gives them time to pause and think before they actually do something about what they're feeling.
It helps to slow things down, mm-hmm. It sounds like.
Yeah, that's a good point. So we're doing a lot of very explicit education around emotional awareness. So teaching them what it means to identify the emotions and then to use the practices we're teaching them to make better choices about how they want to respond to the situations.
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing how Stanford researchers are teaching mindfulness to children in East Palo Alto to help them combat the impact of the environments that they live in. And our guests tonight are Dr. John Redker, Director of the Mindfulness Program at Stanford University's Early Life Stress and Pediatric Anxiety Program, Michael Fu, second-year medical student and teacher in the Mindfulness Program, and Amica Guillaume, principal of the Cesar Chavez Academy in East Palo Alto. We'd like to hear from you if you'd like to join our conversation tonight. 415-841-4134 is our number. Are you a teacher who works with at-risk kids who's interested in learning more about the mindfulness approach? Are you a yoga or meditation practitioner and you'd like to know more? 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment at KLW's website. So, Amica Guillaume, I wanted to get back to you. So, how did you respond to John and Michael coming into the school? And then, of course, how did the kids respond?
Well, I was very excited because I'm a firm believer that anytime any of our children can have a healthy relationship with an adult who's caring and wants the best for them, all the better. So I tend to jump at such opportunities. And so the first year actually was with third grade. It was two classrooms of 25, so 50 third graders. I think the students did a fantastic job. It helps that they have phenomenal teachers. I do want to note that those two third grade classrooms had, now that they're in fourth grade, continue to have zero office referrals for behavior that's not allowed at school. I don't know if that's a correlation to the fact that they have awesome teachers or they were in mindfulness or both. But I'm so impressed with that group of children, and everyone considers them these golden children. So,
And they're not participating in the second year.
They were not participants in the second year, but whatever worked last year has carried over to fourth grade. Mm. And this year we did it with seventh grade, and I remember sitting in a meeting with John, some other principals, and assistant superintendent, and I thought of our seventh grade because we had some challenges finalizing their math science teacher. I felt like they needed this. They really come to school as being the place, as I mentioned before, where they can be centered and whole, and here we had issues with securing the right teacher. And so I really felt like it was an important priority for our seventh grade. I knew that Ms. Coates, the seventh grade language arts social studies teacher, is another wonderful teacher who would be open to this and would find the value in it. So it was just a perfect marriage.
Mm. And so tell us more about the teachers. How did the teachers participate, shape the way this program unfolded? What feedback were you getting from them?
Well, I think John and Michael can speak to how they physically participated.
Literally.
We definitely had a learning curve. Most of our students are second language learners, so some of the terminology needed to be clarified so that students could participate more, I think, accurately or wholly. But in general, particularly this year, the teacher made many comments, and I'm sorry she can't join us this evening, but she made many comments about how it was even helping her. And I know a lot of teachers who work in schools like ours get what is called compassion fatigue. So even her opportunity to think about the work and think about mindfulness helped her be a better teacher.
So John, back to you. Tell us a little bit about how the program took shape in its first year. What were you aiming to accomplish, and what questions were you trying to answer? And then how did what you found out in the first year shape this year?
Yeah, so in our first year, we were really piloting the curriculum. So we kind of went in just seeing how it would work, really, was our main goals. You know, was this program feasible? Did the schools find it useful? And you know, would they want to continue the program in the future were some questions. And then we wanted to look at some behavioral and emotional outcomes. So we used something that's called the behavioral assessment system for children, which is a measure that looks at different things such as school problems, different emotional problems, and as well as adjustment. So that sort of came out of meeting with the principals and finding out what some of the information was that they were interested in. And so we essentially had an 8-week curriculum that was adapted from the work of Amy Saltzman and John Kabat-Zinn. And we went into each class session with a certain theme of mindfulness we were hoping to teach in that particular class. So one example is something like compassion. So how can we teach the kids what it means to be compassionate? Mm-hmm. So in each class, we would have this kind of teaching module on what compassion is, how can we offer that to other people. We would go through our mindfulness practices like yoga practice, or we'd teach them something called an eating meditation where they would eat a raisin or mindfully. Mm-hmm. So fun activities and trying to figure out what were the best ways of bringing this into the classroom environment, and kind of drawing upon the expertise of the teachers to help us and guide us in offering this program. Me being a clinician and a researcher, not a classroom teacher, I needed a lot of support from the teachers on how to translate some of these kind of very abstract concepts into a language that a third or fourth grader could understand. So they were very helpful in that regard. And certainly around the classroom management, helping us maintain an orderly classroom, even when we're doing yoga and having a lot of fun. So,
Michael, what's that like to try to get children to third graders of all to really embrace these kinds of things that may not have been in their consciousness prior? And how do you translate some of these things to get them hooked?
So I would say the third graders were probably more open to it than the seventh graders at first, because the seventh graders, you know, you have one, when we did the mindful eating exercise with the seventh graders, you had one or two of the students who chose to do it, and then the others were like, oh, I'm not going to eat a raisin. But then the rest, as they saw their friends eat, and this, you know, sort of smiles on their face, everybody sort of caught on. And and you bring up a good point, because a lot of these mindful practices are things that the students have never done before. We had three out of like 32 students in our second year who had even heard of the term, and they'd heard of it through the movies or their friends. And so part of it is getting them to overcome this idea that what they're going to be doing is a little strange. The fact that you're going to be breathing with a jewel on your belly button is strange, right? So it comes with a lot of front loading of expectations and rule setting, and sort of we're building a safe environment for us. And so we have dedicated orientation classes where we acknowledge that the things that we're going to be doing are a little bit weird, but that we're going to build a trusting environment, and that you are not pressured to do any of this at all, and that we welcome you to try, but then if it goes beyond your limits of comfort, then you stop, you step back, and then you can jump right back into this if you want to again. So it's just constant reinforcement of this is new for all of us, and we're going to do this together.
And how did children express what was happening to them, so to speak, what they were experiencing? How difficult was it for them to put to words what you were trying to raise to their consciousness?
Yeah, one of the things that we did in each class session is we had what we called a weekly check-in sheet. So at the top of the sheet at the beginning of class, there was essentially a row across the page of pictures of faces. One would be a happy face, sad face, calm face, and then there'd be an option for them to write in what some other emotion might be. And so we would have them circle, you know, what their feeling was at the beginning of the class, and we would take them through our practices, and then at the end of the class they would again circle a face on how they were feeling at the end. So we saw a lot of calm at the end, relaxed at the end, happy at the end, which, you know, is a shift from some of the times at the beginning they'd be feeling tired or they'd be feeling sad or something like that. So that was one way that they could communicate it with us, was through the pictures on the worksheets. And we tried to also just ask them to tell us in words how it might be helping them.
And what were some of those words?
Mm-hmm. So a lot of the students, so each student is different. So we had many modalities through which they could express these feelings. So one was the circling of the emotions. Two was the expression of words. And a lot of students would express after doing yoga that they felt a lot more calm, and they felt their bodies were looser, and they were happier, and they were sometimes a little sleepy after the yoga, but they would express these genuine thoughts about how they were feeling. And then some kids are just artistic. And so we also had art activities that they could do to express these feelings. And one distinctly sticks in my mind where the student drew a picture of himself being invincible, and what his idea of looking invincible was like on paper. And he wasn't a student that necessarily is going to be the one that shares with you and the class verbally what he feels, but on that piece of paper, what he drew, it was very clear that he felt strong and always possible after doing the exercises that we did. So it comes in various forms, and each student was very different.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Tonight we're discussing mindfulness and meditation and how it may help at-risk youth to change the way they respond to their environments. Our guests here tonight are Dr. John Redker and Michael Fu of Stanford University, and Amica Guillaume, principal of Cesar Chavez Academy in East Palo Alto. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. If you have an experience with mindfulness and want to talk about it and how it might apply to children, welcome to call 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment at KLW's website. So now I wanted to turn to Markel Coates, actually, who managed to join us this evening after all. Very happy to hear that you're able to speak with us. She teaches social studies in English in one of the seventh grade classes, I guess, that is participating in this year's Mindfulness and Meditation program. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about the experience you've had so far this year.
So the mindfulness program was a powerful program that we did we did a 10-week program with the mindfulness. And the students, I will say, started out a little bit nervous or a little bit shy to want to do the program, just nerves and getting used to something new. But by the end of the 10 weeks, they were quite eager to participate in mindfulness, and they were even helping me as a teacher remember some of the the strategies, like if things weren't going well in the classroom, or things were really hectic, like the phone ringing, kids not listening, or kids turning in stuff late, or something, anything that could be an interruption. The kids were like, "Miss Coates, remember mindfulness, do some breathing." And so it was a real encourager for me as an educator, because it's my eighth year of teaching, and sometimes we kind of forget just the some of the things we can do in the classroom to help us. And mindfulness has been eye-opening for me this year, just to be able to relieve stress and just to be mindful of my surroundings and things that can encourage and help the kids to get through tough times.
And what have you seen? You mentioned some of the ways in which the children are sort of collaborative in a way perhaps they might not have been with you and supporting you. What are some of the things you're noticing in the way they approach their studies and the way that they manage challenging situations that are coming up for them?
I've seen many students focus on the positive. So if something's going on where someone does something that they don't like or says something they don't like, they don't use, like, a negative tone. They try their best to say, you know, "I didn't like what you just said," or "Can you be mindful of what you say to me, because I don't like when you talk rudely to me." Now, it doesn't happen every time, but I have seen the domino effect of if a kid uses an approach that they were taught, because we went over different scenarios in the mindfulness program of things that can trigger you to get frustrated or become upset and ways that they can overcome that. So many of the students on a day-to-day use that to help them focus and not become angry. And to me, it's something that they're using together. So it may be like a student might say something and then another student piggyback on it, and then it makes the student feel comfortable to be able to try it out. So it's not just like one person using it. I think they're all coming together to support one another, as well as, like I said earlier, supporting me as well as the teacher.
So it's sort of the rebuilding the norms of the classroom community, it sounds like.
Yes.
Yeah. And so so how long did you already go through the 10 weeks this year already?
We have completed the 10 weeks. But just recently, I did like a check-in with the students, asking them how, after seeing the mindfulness program, the snippet on the news, the PBS hour, the students wrote how they feel about being on TV, one, and then how they feel about just being able to see how powerful what we've learned, like how powerful it is. And many of them said that they want to continue to do it. We used to do it every single Friday. And so we do use the strategies in the class, but we haven't done, like, so much the breathing and the different stances and poses that we usually do regularly on Fridays. So they actually said, you know, "We want to do this." And so my idea is to have the students regularly, like maybe two times a week, the students help me lead it instead of it just being me. So it's like a collaboration piece and like the norm in our class. So we're working on that. Fourth quarter starts in a couple of weeks, and so we're trying to get the last quarter where we do something in that nature.
And sounds like a really fun and unexpected way to really, you know, change the trajectory of your classroom. How would you like to see this go further or farther?
I would like to see it across the board in my district. I know when we started the school year, Michael and his staff and other colleagues of his came out and taught the teachers about mindfulness, and I think that that would be a good idea. But I think instead of making, like, having the teachers feel like, "Oh my goodness, I have to do this in my class," getting teachers to understand how this could help them, and then like coming up with the plan of how they will use it. But getting them to understand that this is not a requirement of like X, Y, and Z, you have to do it this way, but just getting them to understand there are some strategies you may take and use more often, and then there are some you may not use as much. But I would like to see it throughout the school as a tool, just to get the kids to redirect themselves instead of the teacher having to tell them, like, "Sit in your seat, think about what you're doing." We will still have to continue to do that, but we probably will have to do less the more they become mindful of their surroundings, mindful of different things that come to play.
Well, I want to thank you for making time out of your busy evening to join us. That was Mark Hill Coates. She teaches social studies and English at the 7th grade level at the Cesar Chavez Academy at East Palo Alto, and she was one of the classrooms that participated in the Mindfulness and Meditation program. Have a great evening.
Thank you.
415-841-4134 if you'd like to join us this evening on City Visions at klw.org. And as we talk about mindfulness and meditation for children, we're joined by Dr. John Redker from Stanford, Michael Fu, a second-year medical student there, and Amica Guillaume, principal of the Cesar Chavez Academy in East Palo Alto. Amica, going through my mind as I was talking with Markel there was, where are the parents in all of this?
Interesting you should mention that, because I do have a group of parents who started doing fitness in the mornings. So they're at our school getting together a group. I don't know that they were involved hands-on in the actual mindfulness practices that we did at school. I do, however, know that they have interest in doing it on their own, and as I mentioned before, they already started their group. We have quite a big group, actually, that come in the morning, so you're giving me a great idea.
And John, what's your thought about how to sort of expand the reach of this by planting the seed, so to speak, in the children and then having them go out into their community and sort of having it grow from there?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we heard from some of the kids was how they would go home and talk about what they were doing and with the mindfulness program. So some of the kids would teach their brothers or their sisters or their cousins some of the yoga poses. They talk about it with their families. And in the first year of the program, we had at the schools like a family fitness night, I think we did with Amica at Chavez, where I taught a group of the families a yoga class. And so things like that, I think, are going to be important to move it forward. And also one of our goals that we would like to do, like Markel was saying, is to invite more school teachers to come in and see what might interest them about learning about mindfulness and how they might use those skills in the classroom. So really, like, working with the teachers who can then teach the kids, and then it seems like the kids are really good at teaching other kids, teaching their families and their siblings, and really making a community effort out of it.
Now, is this something that's expected of you, to see that someone doesn't just take this training or practice for themselves, but really directs it both inward and outward, and it kind of is synergistic? Is that something you've seen in studies like this before, or your experience of what happens to people who participate in mindfulness?
Yeah, I explicitly that wasn't something that I thought about, but it makes a lot of sense to me, because, you know, whenever I first started doing these practices and I noticed how it was really helping me change my experience of stress and change how I'm relating to others and having more patience, more compassion, it's certainly something I'm going to start talking about to my friends, and then they'll want to get on board with that. And so, yeah, I think it's a wonderful kind of unexpected finding for me to hear how the kids are sharing these practices.
Michael? No,
I would agree. I think mindfulness comes with community. You know, you learn it in a group usually, and even the community that John has built with our team, we have many other people that aren't here that are on our team, and it's something that we do to bring ourselves together as well. So it's a very shareable experience, and it's more powerful that way.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Deborah from Palo Alto. Welcome to the program, Deborah.
Thank you.
Do you have a question or comment for our guests?
Yes. I think this is a fantastic idea. I was brought to mindfulness through a serious illness, and had great, great experience with metta, which is another form of mindfulness, in controlling fear. And I think that's another good reason for teaching these children. She said 50% of them are homeless. You know, teach them mindfulness, because they'll be able to deal with fear better. And, you know, fear comes in all sizes and forms, and we can't control what happens to us, but we can control how we react to it. So that was my one comment. And I wanted to know, and I can take the answer off the air, what people like me who live in Palo Alto might be able to do to volunteer for the school. It sounds like a place that could use my help.
Oh, thanks so much, Deborah, for your call. Amica? Any ideas there? And then John, of course, because be curious to hear how you would spread this to people who might be interested in helping out.
Well, I definitely, my last name is complicated, but our email, I don't know if there's a way to connect.
We'll link whatever email you give us to our website, so that way people could just click on it. But if you want to give it over the air, that's fine too.
Well, it's aguillaume@ravenswoodschools.org. So A as in apple, G as in George, U-I-L-L-A-U, M as in Mary, E, at ravenswoodschools.org.
Great. So, yeah, John, what about this? What about people coming forward who may have their own personal experience but not necessarily a training in this area? What would it take for someone to step up in this way?
Yeah, I think creating I teach mindfulness out of my office in Palo Alto, too, so that would be a way of getting connected with me as far as learning more mindfulness, keep the practice going, and working. I don't know how it would work out with the school district to have volunteers, but that's something we'd have to kind of brainstorm a bit more about. But there's many opportunities to at least come to my classes and mm-hmm. learn from me in Palo Alto.
415-841-4134, or you can email us at cityvisions@klw.org. Let's go to Rajiv, who's calling from San Francisco. Rajiv, welcome to the program.
Hi. I just want to say that what you described of mindfulness sounded really great. And I was kind of curious about how the rest of us can also learn similar techniques or go through a similar training program.
All right. Thanks for your call. I'll let you take your answer off the air.
Sure. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Back to you, John.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So there's... I mentioned earlier mindfulness-based stress reduction. That's an approach that's taught at all the major medical centers, all the major universities, pretty much across the country for sure, and in many other countries as well. So in San Francisco, UCSF has a mindfulness class there that people can sign up for and take and go through the mindfulness-based stress reduction and have their experience of it. And often, I think at least once a year, Jon Kabat-Zinn comes out as well and offers some more training on it for people that want to teach. And all of the yoga classes I teach in San Francisco as well has a very strong mindfulness philosophy in it. So that's another way to learn as well.
Hmm. And so I'm thinking, what's on tap for next year? It sounds like you've had a great, successful 2 years. What's the next step for this program?
So we've always built our program off of feedback from whatever the school district wants from us. So it's very school district driven. And so our whole goal right now, our hope is to present what we found with the changes that we found in the students because of mindfulness to the school board and to see, you know, do we want to take this to a district-wide level? That was the initial plan, that we would pilot it in you know, several classrooms and see what sort of changes would happen. And the goal was then to use it as a way to do positive behavioral interventions and supports within the school district. And so the ultimate goal would be, as was what Ms. Coates said, is to be able to equip teachers with a tool that they could employ in their classrooms and adapt it in a way that is fitting for themselves and for their kids. But we need to respond to whatever the school district says. So we don't know, you know, if it's budget constraints or time constraints, but we plan to be very responsive to whatever happens there. And John and I have also discussed building a mindfulness community to support this effort. And so, because right now we're working out of our Stanford team, but as John mentioned, there's so many people practicing mindfulness in the Bay Area that we want to be able to also build a good foundation of resources for schools that want to do this as well. So that's another thing on our minds.
Amika, what are you hearing from school district and other folks about the sustainability or the expansion of this kind of program, or just keeping it at your school or growing it at your school?
Well, I definitely think an easy first step would be to grow it at our school site. I think Michael's correct in that we do need to present to the board, because I would actually love the opportunity to be posed difficult questions and to really deep about did this work and why did it and what can we do to move it forward. I did also want to mention that my work with the Deanna Moran Foundation for Nonviolence, one of the lessons we've taught and shared around the country is about controlling anger for the sake of nonviolence, because yes, we're talking about kids doing better in school, but we're talking about a world where if people think twice before they act and if they're mindful of their actions, it means the world in general will be a better place.
This reminds me of a show we had, a few weeks ago, where we had we profiled the GRIP program, or Guiding Rage into Power program, that is that's currently at San Quentin State Prison, where inmates there are actually learning mindfulness techniques to learn how to connect to emotions and to create a healing process for themselves as they face the reasons why they're incarcerated and how they can change the trajectory of their lives afterwards. And so for me, to see this sort of this happening at various life stages is quite interesting. And I'm curious, John, has there been any research that can point to how these kinds of programs can really affect things on a larger scale, right? We've talked about how children in the classrooms are helping themselves out, helping their teacher out and each other out, bringing their parents in. But what about the long-range impact? You've talked about how the stresses, we actually had your colleague Victor Carrion on this program several years ago to talk about adverse childhood events and how they really impact people for the lifespan. Do you see how things like this can really counteract that impact, the negative impact of growing up in a stressful, traumatic, and violent environment?
Yeah, I think one of the key factors is these skills bring an internal sense of ease, an internal sense of peace. And if you're feeling that sort of contentment within your own being, there's less of perhaps a desire to act out in violence. So as we're teaching individuals to work with their internal experience and to learn how to sit with things like anger or sadness or depression and use these practices as a way to heal, then there won't be that sort of acting out of violence in communities, and also learning how to communicate with others and more peaceful methods, I think, is something that will come out of this. As far as specific research on that, I don't know that I've seen anything yet on that. Most of the research I focus on is the kind of mental health outcomes and behavioral outcomes.
So, Amaka, tell us about how you would see a program like this, if it were to expand to your school, really change the culture around discipline in your school. You know, we talked on this show recently about kind of what modes of discipline are really the right ways to guide behavior and shape behavior in school environments. How do you see something like this really looking at that? I know that my sense is from your comments earlier on that you really get the connection between the behavior you see and the environment that the children swim in. Tell us what you see long term for the pedagogical model, the disciplinary model for your school.
Well, we subscribe as a district to the positive behavior intervention or response intervention model, which is really focusing on the whole child and focusing on positive interventions before we get into the word discipline and consequence. We are also a full inclusion school where we have a chunk of about 11% of our students have special needs or IEPs. So the idea of how we work with children already is one in which we need to be mindful of the child and the whole child. What I love about this in particular is that even if you just take the case study of Ms. Coates' class, it was so funny because when we did the interviews for the PBS NewsHour, they said to us, well, we'd like to speak further with the following two students. And we all kind of giggled to ourselves and we thought, oh gosh, do we want on national television our two biggest rascals representing our school? And that's exactly what it is. It's giving students like those students who have a lot to say, for better or for worse, the language and the opportunity from an asset perspective, right? So we're looking at how do we build the assets of all children, especially those of high needs, so that they can become effective individuals, because it's really about building self-efficacy. And one of our most important parts of our motto is dream big, work hard, and give back. And no one can do any of those three things if they don't have mindfulness or the ability to express themselves.
And how does this connect with other movements like restorative justice that we see here in San Francisco, but in schools? Is that something that you feel like connects well with that?
Well, funny you should mention that, because we also work with the EPA Youth Court, and we have a group of students in 6th and 7th grade being trained as youth court facilitators for restorative justice for students who are receiving referrals for not following school rules. And it is very important because, again, when a child gets into trouble, you really have to look at the entire story. I think sometimes we joke that we are detectives first before we are disciplinarians, because you really need to figure out, do I understand the whole picture, and that's it.
Yep. Did we lose you?
No, I'm still here.
Oh, there you go. Go ahead, please.
I think we
I don't know what you said at the end there, but just repeat your last statement there, because I'm not sure that we heard it.
I think I was mentioning about the restorative justice and how the two work hand in hand, because you need to have the language,
mm-hmm.
And you need to have the perspective that anytime you're going to work with a child who's, I think, John, you used the word highly agitated or something to that effect. Anytime you're about to engage with a child, you need to stop, pause, and actually ask yourself, is this even the correct time to talk to the child? If they have heightened emotions, then really I just need to let them rest and breathe. Because if we're going to get into restorative justice, if we're going to get into the conversation of rebuilding the child and rebuilding the relationship that was harmed by the interaction, then the child needs to be whole first and be able to speak and articulate themselves. And if they're huffing and puffing and expletives come out, that is not the time, and that's mindfulness.
Right. And Michael, as a soon-to-be medical doctor, how do you see the experience that you are having right now? How do you see this informing your practice moving forward?
Well, it's
your
a big
medical practice.
That's a big question. You know, I'm very interested in working with at-risk adolescents, youth in general, but adolescents specifically. And I think when I was a teacher, I always wanted to have the tools to be able to work with students on these mental, like social, emotional issues that they were having. I just didn't know how. So I do feel a lot more prepared now, and there's a lot more learning to do for me as I go on. But it's a great adjunct to my medical education, because it provides me with skills that don't necessarily get taught in medical school about how to work with this population. And so I think I definitely believe that I will be more prepared to handle those situations, and I feel more confident that as a practicing physician, I will be able to assume those responsibilities as they come.
And how is your participation helping you in getting through medical school?
Oh, it is great. Like, you don't understand how awesome it is on a Thursday meeting to meet with John and our other teammate, Julia, to do a mindfulness session and a meditation session and sort of just de-stress at the end of the week. And just it changes your perspective on and rejuvenates you. So it's the greatest experience.
And in the last few moments of our program, John, tell us more about kind of where you see this going beyond this school district in particular, and some things that if you could speak to the school board now, what would you want to be telling them?
Yeah, I think one of the main things we can do is weave this program into the culture of school districts and school systems, so that mindfulness practices become a part of the daily routine in the schools. And I think we can extend that not only working with students, but working with teachers, administrators. And I think really it's about creating, as Tim Ryan says, a mindful nation in his book, if you've seen that book. Yeah. So I think the research is there for the effectiveness of these practices, and now it's about kind of taking the action steps to put it into place.
And it sounds like there's people out there willing and wanting to do it now. How do we fund it and grow it, which is, of course, always where we have to leave the conversation. So I want to thank my guests this evening for joining me in quite an interesting conversation. And our guests tonight were Dr. John Redker and Michael Fu from Stanford University, and Amica Guillaume. And earlier we heard from Markel Coates, and they are both from the Cesar Chavez Academy in East Palo Alto. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you so
pleasure
much.
To be here.
For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Kevin Vance. Tonight's show was produced by Victoria Thorpe. Susie Britton is our senior producer. Join my co-host David Onick next week as we have a conversation for Women's History Month about how women leaders are changing the face of feminism. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week.